welcome to Didion Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DHNI. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast. Hello, hello, and welcome to the show. Today's episode is about a topic that I think about constantly lately, because I just wrote an essay about it, especially regarding this novel, though, that we're reading for our Thursday's series, Infinite Jest. So I thought I would take the opportunity to talk a little bit about my unpublished theoretical sort of work regarding footnotes, and the cognitive and referential implications behind them, as well as play a sort of game with footnotes from Infinite Jest at the end of the episode. So without further ado, let's get into it. Starting with the history of footnotes, in the 17th century, Western Europe made marked improvements to systems that spread literature and knowledge, which contributed to innovations in thought such as the Enlightenment and Enlightenment ideals, as well as innovations in formal structures such as the footnote. That is from Anderson, who is an author that is cited in the description. Footnotes were first incorporated as a disorganized yet useful form of commentary from a given text's readership, rather than comments or citations from the authors of a text as they were most commonly seen later on and also today. That's a quote and a summary from Kennedy. Indeed, footnotes were often incorporated interlinearly or marginally, unquote, eventually with help from symbols. Arabic numbers were not used until much later, however. The two definitive authorities on the history of the footnote are Chuck Zerbe, and he wrote a book called The Devil's Details, A History of Footnotes, and Anthony Grafton. His book is called The Footnote, A Curious History. The former volume catalogs the earliest uses of footnotes and elects a man named Richard Yuga as the first organizer of the modern footnote. That's pages 17 to 45 in Zerbe's text. The latter volume discusses the evolution of the footnote in the field of history, examining how the footnote became an integral part of academic historical literature. That's Grafton, pages 62 to 94. And the story behind Richard Yuga's participation in the footnote, by the way, is that he was the first person, interestingly enough, to organize footnotes at the end of the page with their corresponding numbers. He did so as part of an assignment to revise the Geneva Bible for the Anglican Bible. Again, that's a quote and source from Kennedy. Getting on with my work about footnotes and reference, there are a couple of views that I have entertained thus far about how the structure affects the statements within footnotes that refer to some entity or other, and the one I lately think is the most convincing asks whether footnotes create a context or space within a text that assumes a referential status for the sentences within the footnotes. Let's back up for a second here, though, and talk about reference so that we all have a better common ground to work from. Reference is an epic field of study within the realm of pragmatics, if I do say so myself, but important for you to know for this episode are a few things. First, sentences themselves do not make reference. People make reference. Therefore, the sentence, "My lamp is broken," cannot constitute a successful act of reference unless I use it as such within an appropriate context. Second, that context matters. If I walked up to you on the street and said, "My lamp is broken," right off the bat, discourse initial, my act of reference would fail, and no one wants that. So if I were intending to be successful, which most people are when they're making a reference, I would of course wait until a more appropriate time to refer to the broken lamp, etc., etc. You get the point. This kind of reference, where I wait until the appropriate time to refer to my lamp, and that statement does not come off as weird when I say it, is called a felicitous reference. Felicity is different from success, though, so I could have a felicitous act of reference where I bring up the lamp at the right time to a person who knows in some way about the lamp or could assume something about the lamp, but that person might mistake the lamp for an incorrect lamp or doesn't understand at all or maybe thinks that the lamp is a chair instead, and all of those things would cause my delicate balancing act of reference to fail, even though it was felicitous. Third, reference is much, much more than this episode and much, much more than just a linguistic phenomenon. It also has a cognitive background and a psychological background and a philosophical one. So if you have more interest in all of that, I have cited a few sources down below to get you started. Getting back to the theory at hand, I think the best way to treat this view is through something that is well known and well studied, especially from linguistics, which is the concept of imaginary worlds. Barbara Abbott, in her work Reference, cites that, quote, David Lewis, 1978, argues that examples like Sherlock Holmes played the violin are true only when heard with a tacit prefix, something like according to such and such fiction. That's on page 265. Taking this view into account provides that the footnote may itself constitute a kind of tacit prefix, or in other words, a linguistic device that sets up the appropriate context for the listener, in this case the reader, to understand the referential sentences within it. Thus, footnotes themselves, as well as their corresponding sentences from the main text, seem to work together as a tacit prefix for that footnote. Another feature to consider is whether or not there's also an embedding quality within footnotes. I like to think of this feature as something similar to what happens referentially with a period drama, as period dramas can simultaneously have a highly referential context to start out with, as well as individual uses of sentences with the goals of reference within them. So the sentence, Jack the Ripper killed 3 victims last night, this is my sentence by the way, would be felicitous when used referentially in a period drama, whereas without the context of a similar tacit prefix, i.e. the context provided by the period drama, a modern day conversation would render the utterance infelicitous. Continuing on, Jack would already be a salient and activated, and this notion of activation comes from Lambrecht, cited below, discourse entity in a period drama taking place between 1888 and 1891, 90, about there around, whereas again, some further context would need to be developed in order for someone to take a felicitous reference about him in the modern day. I have a lot more to say about footnotes and, for example, community membership and what authors might be anticipating when it comes to their intended or expected audiences, but I'll leave the theoretical talk here for now so that we can get on to our game. So the game's rules are simple. I'm going to flip through the footnotes that we've already gotten to in Infinite Jest, pick random ones, and try to analyze them at first glance without their sentence correspondence from the main text, just to see how well I do, and hopefully the game will also get us all thinking more about the usefulness of footnotes, specifically regarding footnote usage in Infinite Jest, and sort of the devices that footnotes really become when they're referenced and put inside the novel. So I've come across a footnote here that is quite long. It's footnote 123 on page 1023 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text. And here we have a footnote that seems to be narrated by Pemulus, and he's, from my recollection, he's talking about the mechanics of Eschaton, and he's really working out the mathematics part with the extreme value theorem of Eschaton. I love this footnote because it has so much specific knowledge, and so here's a footnote that really has a lot to say about specific technical knowledge that an average reader of a text wouldn't want to go into. So one of the really valuable uses of footnotes that I've seen in just looking at footnotes for my research has been when an author uses footnotes basically to specify and to go further into detail where a generalist audience would not want to go. So in any sort of text, an author really has to cater very carefully to the expected generalist audience. So just someone maybe in academia, someone who loves literature in the case of Infinite Jest, who really doesn't know a lot about the mechanics of the literature involved. They don't really care about that kind of in-depth specificity. And then they also, the author, they have to cater to the specialists in their field as well. So they simultaneously have to make something that's, you know, wildly informative, but still within the realms of understanding for their generalist audience, and as well make something that's highly specific and highly useful for people within their same field, something that people in their same field say, yes, this is actually a really cool contribution that you've made to our field. And I think one way that people do this is through footnotes. So I love how DFW is taking on all of these different academic hats in this novel, and this is definitely a mathematics type footnote where someone interested in mathematics and how all of this might actually work would definitely benefit more from this footnote than, for example, me, where I just read it and I'm like, ah, numbers are letters. I don't remember much calculus from high school. You know, it's informative and it's sort of helpful to have the diagrams as well here, as I'm seeing. But yeah, I think it's just, it's cool. And it's also cool to have Pemulus's voice throughout this footnote. And we don't get a lot of something narrated by Pemulus in the novel, so it's also a cool tonal shift where we have a different narrator altogether for a few moments. So the next footnote I've landed on is footnote 110, but I actually landed on the middle. I landed on pages 1006 and 1007, so I think I'll just comment on that since this is another huge footnote. And I realize now a flaw in this game, which is that I'm more likely to land on a really long footnote than a short one. So I'll try to vary my random drawings a little more. Maybe they won't be so random then, but hopefully it'll be a little more interesting. So this footnote starts out with a title, which I think is so interesting, is that you're embedding format within a footnote. So footnote here is going to be more like a narrative structure than a commentary. It's really an extension. I almost think of this footnote as functioning like fan fiction or something. Maybe a sort of period drama. I know we mentioned period dramas earlier, but I think sort of you have the original Wuthering Heights, and in this case the original would of course be the main narrative, and then you have H, which is this sort of like fan fiction type historical drama written a couple years ago that was also wildly famous. And so it was sort of an extension of the time and the story frame of Wuthering Heights. And I think this is sort of the same thing. Of course, it's more authentic because it's written by the same author within the same binding even. But yeah, that's how I think of it, is this. There's a reason why this isn't within the main text, right? There's a reason why it's in a footnote, but and I think it's because perhaps DFW was going for this sort of novel quality that the footnote lends it. So I think the footnote in this case is working as an extension. A lot of DFW's footnotes indeed do work in this way, where he uses them to extend either a specific narrative thread in the novel for a couple more pages, or he uses them to extend a character by lending the character a couple lines or even a couple pages of room for their voice, as we just saw with Pemulus. But in this case, the novel sort of mood that the footnote sets, I think, is a really invaluable trait, where we have this letter that's printed by the New Orleans Saints on page 1007 to Miss Incandenza in response to something she's written for her son. And it's just, that is a little disturbing, number one, where we're seeing how distanced Orin and Averill are to each other, and then also the sort of copy-paste formatting that DFW is using, where it's sort of like a typewriter print that's filling in the blanks in this passage. And it's, yeah, I think that's something that's really interesting. And also the structure of these two pages of this footnote, in terms of there's a formal section title, as we would see in the main text, and then there's a letter, and then there's the response to that letter, and so the letter is pretty heartfelt, I mean, in Avril's sort of clinical way. And then we get this ultra removed, ultra distanced response from Oren's employer of all things back to Avril. And then we get some more dialogue and some more tidbits and insights into Oren's character and how he is responding to this interview type situation, things he's thinking about during this thread, all of which are tremendously important, of course. And I love how the footnote is the place where DFW again chooses to put this kind of information. This is footnote 8, the next footnote I landed on. It is a shorter one, so this one is actually describing a drug, and it has a footnote within a footnote, which I really think is interesting. So the footnote within the footnote I like because DFW is really pushing the envelope with a lot of his footnote techniques. And so if you think about a normal text, an author will expect maybe, I don't want to guess low, but 25% of the readership to read the footnotes of their text. It's not common these days for someone to really walk back the cat with all the sources and the footnotes and everything. I do this because I find those kinds of things useful and relevant, but many people, and I understand, you know, why, they're just trying to get through the reading in general. They don't have time to add a bunch of time onto their plate with footnotes of all things. But here, DFW is almost making fun of that fact and that reality, where we have this footnote and then, oh, we've gone as far to read the footnotes, so why not read the footnote's footnote? And so I like that because he's laughing in the face of what, or the direction that modern literature is going these days. And interestingly, in my readings, I've come across this sort of shift where in the past, universities were the main buyers of academic literature. And of course, they did that because they were able to rent out and give out textbooks to students and classes, and that was the primary mode of where academic literature was consumed. But nowadays, academic literature is more so and more frequently consumed by just everyday average consumers. And so that shift has really changed the way that these books are formatted. I'll give an example. So you have a book like Grit by Angela Duckworth. This book is wildly popular for good reason. It's great research, and I like Angela Duckworth's mode of presentation. I like her work. So it's a very popular book though, right? It's not this dry, dense sort of writing. There aren't a ton of like footnotes and citations, right? She converts them all to endnotes, at least in the edition I have. And I really think this shift in structure, where you're taking, for example, footnotes and converting them often into endnotes, is a direct result from this change in readership in academic texts. A book like Grit, for example, there's a lot that goes into the cover design and making the book marketable and approachable to a more generalist audience, which is really what we're seeing nowadays. And so I find it really interesting because David Foster Wallace wrote this book at sort of the big transition into this digital age, where we're seeing this exact shift from universities of being the consumers to everyday people being the consumers. And yet he still really relies on footnotes. And this is not even something he exclusively talks about or does in Infinite Jest. It's also something that's really prominent in Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. The footnotes in that book are crazy. It's sort of like the footnotes in Musicophilia by Oliver Sacks. The references in that book, and I'm assuming his other works as well, though I haven't read many, unfortunately, those footnotes are insane. And I just really enjoyed, honestly, reading all the footnotes. I really made myself sit down and read all of them in Musicophilia, and it was a great experience. But again, I'm the kind of person that, you know, I'm a specialist in fields like music and like communication, so I glean a lot from those footnotes. Whereas if I were a generalist, you know, for example, in a book about sports, I probably wouldn't read the footnotes. And the last footnote that I've landed on here is footnote 21 on page 985. And I didn't mention the page number for footnote 8, that's 984, the previous page, but yeah, footnote 21, it says QV note 211 sub, and this note 211 is really important for this book, but we'll save that for a later time. So I actually just found a Reddit thread pertaining to this exact footnote, and it says, "I'm so confused reading this book. I understand the basic storyline, but this book is so intimidating, and I feel like I'm only getting 30% of the information." This is one of the footnotes, 21 QV note 211 sub. What does that even mean? It makes no sense to me. Am I too stupid for this book? And oh goodness, do I commiserate with you, Reddit user? I think this is exactly the kind of language that a lot of texts and footnotes, again, are avoiding these days because people find it cumbersome and archaic and whatnot. I like the Latin here, so this QV essentially just says go to the footnote 211 because footnote 211 also contains relevant information that you may want to review at this point rather than wait all the way until you get to footnote 211. And it's a really short one. This is like one of the shortest footnotes in the couple pages that I'm looking at here. And so in terms of the actual function and why DFW is using this notation here, I think that he's using it for stylistic effect in some ways. So this book teeters on the edge of many academic fields, a lot of information, such as in medicine and in mathematics and of course in physics, as we now know is very important to the book. Though those fields really contribute, and I think in some ways DFW is using this sort of archaic language for a stylistic effect, if anything else. Alright, so to close out today, I have two movies to recommend to you. The first is called The Florida Project, and the second is called Systemsprenger. And they're both really heavy hitters in the emotions department, but they're two films that I've seen recently and that have just been weighing on me a lot and have really affected me. So I think the best films are films that you can't walk away from when you leave the theater. There are films that just last with you. It's sort of like a good book in that way. It's a book where you just think about it and think about it days later. And so these two films have really affected me recently, and I would totally recommend them because they're just so challenging, and I think they would suit listeners of this podcast. So have a great one. I will see you on Thursday, and be well. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.